Then two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. The one woman said, "Oh my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. Then, on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth, and we were alone. There was no one else in the house with us. Only we two were in the house, and this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. And she rose at midnight and took my son from me beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast. When I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I had born." But the other woman said, "No, the living child is mine. The dead child is yours." The first said, "No, the dead child is yours. The living child is mine." Thus they spoke before the king. Then the king said, "One says this is my son that is alive, and your son is dead. The other says, 'No, but your son is dead, and my son is the living one.'" And the king said, "Bring me a sword." So a sword was brought before the king. And the king said, "Divide the living child in two, and give half to one and half to the other." Then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for her son, "O my lord, give her the living child, and by no means put him to death." But the other said, "He shall neither be mine nor yours. Divide him." Then the king answered and said, "Give the living child to the first woman, and by no means put him to death. She is his mother." And all Israel heard of the judgment that the king had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king, because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to do justice.
Thanks so much. Well, I wonder whether you solved the riddle, or whether, like the people at the time, you marvel at the wisdom of this king, this man. Over the next 3 weeks, we're going to be looking at Solomon, this great king. He was the son of David, perhaps the most famous of all of the kings of Israel. And he was the builder of the temple in Jerusalem, one of the wonders of the ancient world, and arguably history's richest man. That's at least how we've advertised this series. And apologies if you've come here as a banker or something, hoping that I'm going to justify this claim. I did actually try to do a calculation of his net worth, and then I realised I wasn't really competent to do that. And then I realised that some of you probably are. So maybe in your job you value companies or work out how much you'll insure people for or how much you could sue them for. And so my challenge to you is to work out, if you can, for next week, Solomon's net worth as the king. But suffice to say, he was a pretty wealthy guy. I'm just going to read you some of the data that comes from the following chapter in 1 Kings. Chapter 4, verse 20. "The people of Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate and they drank and were happy. And Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines as far as the border of Egypt. These countries brought tribute and were Solomon's subjects all his life. Solomon's daily provisions were 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal, 10 head of stall-fed cattle, 20 of pasture-fed cattle, and 100 sheep and goats, as well as deer, gazelles, roebucks, and choice fowl." Almost not worth mentioning, but they're also available on the buffet. "He ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river, from Tephath to Gaza, had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety. Solomon had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses and 12,000 horses. The district officers, each in his month, supplied provisions from King Solomon and all who came to the king's table. They saw to it that nothing was lacking. They also brought to the proper place their quotas of barley and straw for the chariot horses and other horses," and so on. So this was a man who was extraordinarily wealthy. He was partly wealthy because he was so powerful. He was in control of a huge area. So not only was he king over Israel and Judah, but they conquered some of the surrounding nations who were now vassal states, who paid their taxes into Solomon's coffers. We read in chapter 10 that boats came in every week laden with gold. And those of you who are doing the calculation, the chapters you need are chapter 4 and chapter 10. You'll see all the numbers. You can work out the commodities pricing, and I look forward to some estimates next week, please, if you're up for that. He was a powerful man, partly because he was a great military man. So before Solomon's day, Israelites had mainly been confined to living up in the hill country. If you've ever been to Israel, you'll know that part of it is very mountainous, and they were fighting fit, they were great at running up and down hills, and they were good at hill warfare. But controlling the huge plains around the area of the Middle East is an entirely different matter. And it was Solomon who brought the initiative of building chariots and chariot cities. And we're told he had 4,000 stalls for chariot horses, 12,000 horses. That's quite an army. With chariots, you can easily cover the vast plains, like the plain of Megiddo, and all of the trading routes in the region. So he was a great military strategist. He was also a great architect. He built these cities. He built the temple at Jerusalem. I had the privilege of travelling around Israel and visiting some of Solomon's cities. And every single one of them now is a UNESCO Grade 1 World Heritage Site. Just phenomenal planning. But as well as being wealthy and powerful, the attribute of Solomon that the Bible most celebrates is that he was wise. And it's his wisdom that we're going to particularly look at today. Actually, there is a connection between his wisdom and his wealth, although it might not be quite the one that we expect. But I want to look at Solomon's wisdom and see what we can learn about the nature of true wisdom. And I'm afraid I'm going to be jumping around over a few chapters of 1 Kings to pick out verses. And if you haven't got a Bible, you'll just have to listen to me reading little excerpts and go and check yourself later. But firstly, Solomon was somebody who recognised that wisdom was valuable. In fact, he knew that his wisdom counted for more than his great wealth. Let me read to you from chapter 3 and verse 4. The king went to Gibeon to offer sacrifices, for that was the most important high place, and Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings at that altar. At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon during the night in a dream, and God said to him, "Ask me for whatever you want me to give you." But that is quite an encounter, isn't it? Just imagine that. I do a summer camp, Christian summer camp in August, and during my talk this year, my mobile telephone rang. It's quite embarrassing, interrupted the talk, and I answered it, and it was 10 Downing Street. I put it on speakerphone, and they said, "Oh, this is the Prime Minister's office. Is there anything that we can do for you?" Now, of course, it's actually a setup, because I know a friend who works or worked for David Cameron, as it was then, in 10 Downing Street, and I got her to phone at this exact moment because I thought it would impress all the teenagers, and it did, as an illustration. But it's quite a thought, isn't it? Imagine if that had been for real. You know, David Cameron is asking, or Theresa May now is asking, "Is there anything I can do for you?" Whoa. But actually, this is the same thing, but ramped up thousands of times. This is not just a genie in a bottle. This is the God who makes the whole world. And he says to Solomon, "What would you like? You've got one wish. What would you like?" An amazing encounter. I wonder what you would choose. You could have anything. Solomon said, "I would like to be wise." Verse 6, "You have shown great kindness to your servant, my father David, because he was faithful to you and righteous and upright in heart. You've continued your great kindness to him and have given him a son to sit on his throne. Now, O Lord my God, you've made your servant king in place of my father, but I am only a little child. I don't know how to carry out my duties. Your servant is here among the people you've chosen, a great people, too numerous to count or number. So give your servant a discerning heart to govern your people and to distinguish between right and wrong. For who is able to govern this great people of yours?" The Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked for this. So God said to him, "Since you've asked for this and not for long life or wealth for yourself, nor the death of your enemies, but you've asked for discernment and wisdom in administering justice, I'll do what you've asked. I'll give you a wise and discerning heart, so there'll be none who's ever been like you, nor ever will there be. Moreover, I'll give you what you didn't ask for, both riches and honour. So in your lifetime, you'll have no equal among kings." So Solomon's got a choice. He opts for wisdom. And God says, "Well, that's the right call. And actually, because you asked for wisdom, I'll give you money as well." So he becomes rich and wise. But Solomon, given the choice, and I wonder what you would have chosen. But one wish, you have anything you like. Would you choose, "I'd like an extra million in my bank account," or to be just a little bit wiser? Solomon chose a little bit wiser, and God said that's the right call. Wisdom is a very valuable thing. Now, when the Bible talks about wisdom, it doesn't just mean IQ. Like the occasionally you meet these absolute geniuses. I had a friend a few years ago, friend's brother actually, who was slightly autistic, but had one of those sort of savant abilities for calculating dates. So you could tell him your birthday at any point in history, and he'd tell you what day of the week it is. You could say, "I was born on the 15th of May, 1749. He said that was a Tuesday. Just like that. But wisdom isn't just about having this amazing mental power, nor even is it about the kind of acumen or nous that might make you a packet here in the city. Wisdom here is, well, did you notice, first of all, and unusually, it is altruistic. So Solomon asks for wisdom for other people's sake. It's not just, I want to be really clever so I can make a load of cash. Or, I want to be clever so people think of me as being really clever. You know, gone out of favour now, because I think Jimmy Savile used to be the chairman, didn't he? But Mensa, you know that, the high IQ society. And back when I was growing up, anyway, they used to put adverts in the newspaper, the little IQ test, and if you passed it, you could write off to them, and they'd measure your IQ, and then they'd write back and say, "Congratulations, you're clever enough to join Mensa." And I think actually that was the test, to see whether you were gullible enough to pay 50 quid just to be able to say that you were clever. I think it's probably meant that you weren't very clever. It's a kind of inverse psychology test, perhaps. But this isn't just cleverness so people think you're clever. This is wisdom to serve other people. Solomon prays, "Your servant is here among the people you've chosen, a great people, and I'm like a little child. You know, you give me a huge responsibility, Lord, to govern over this country. What if I stuff it up? So please give me a discerning heart to govern this, your people." So Solomon wants wisdom for other people's sake, so that he can serve them and govern them. And wouldn't it that be a great prayer for our government to pray? "And please give me wisdom for them, so that I can govern them rightly." Wisdom is valuable, wisdom is altruistic. And then notice wisdom is moral. He describes it as a discerning heart to distinguish between right and wrong. Wisdom in the Bible is primarily a moral category. It's not how to get ahead economically or how to make a shrewd political decision. It's what would be the right thing before a moral God to do, and what would be an evil thing to do. In fact, in some ways, in the city, I guess, wisdom is almost the opposite of that. Wisdom is how do you get the best cash deal, almost irrespective of how shady it has to be to get there. And we applaud the person who's sneaky, and God doesn't. For God, it's wise if you do the right moral thing, and it's foolish if you do the evil thing. So it's a moral category. And then notice that wisdom is supremely practical. And we get this brilliant little insight into Solomon's wisdom when here's a court case of two prostitutes. So right at the bottom of society, and they're fighting over this child. Solomon comes up with this brilliant solution, cut the child in half. And immediately the true mother says, in that case, the other woman can have him. And Solomon goes, "Well, that's the true mother. The child thieving mother is perfectly happy to have half a child, but the tree mother would rather have somebody else bring up her child alive." But it's just a little insight into how Solomon's wisdom, apart from being clever, and we're all impressed by it, how Solomon's wisdom benefits everybody in the country, even the prostitute at the very bottom of the ladder, benefits from a king who judges rightly and morally correctly. And so in this case, a family is preserved. And because of all of these things, it's valuable, altruistic, moral, practical, it is a huge blessing to everybody in that country to have a wise king such as Solomon. We read at the end of chapter 4, The people of Judah and Israel was as numerous as the sand on the seashore. They ate and they drank and they were happy. We were studying this last year at church with some friends, and somebody in my group pointed out what a very unusual commentary that is on the state of a nation's life. And whatever you might read in The Economist about, you know, the analysis of Germany at the moment or how we're doing post-Brexit in the UK, yeah, Britain is happy. It's just a very unusual comment, isn't it? Because the point is, we're really not most of the time. We've always got something to grumble about or to be cross about. You may know that the United Nations does occasionally try to measure how happy people are. And they do a world happiness report, apparently, and it was last done a couple of years ago. And the top happiest country was Denmark. And no one really knew why. You know, so, but of course, that means that lots of government officials can now fly to Denmark just to find out exactly how happy they are. And I think those people then become happy because they've got a free holiday to investigate happiness. But it's unusual, isn't it, to read that of a nation. But of course they were. Because being ruled over by a government that is altruistic, cares for the people, and is moral, it does the right thing, there's no shady underdealings, and it's practical, it benefits everybody in society, even down to the very lowest. That is a great place to live. And wouldn't you love to live in Solomon's Israel? Prosperity, justice, wisdom, happiness. It is a great blessing. And yet we read at the end of chapter 4 of 1 Kings that it is very, very unusual to be as wise as this. I'll just read you the paragraph. I love, this is a sort of crowning summary of just how wise he was. And it amuses me. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great insight and a breadth of understanding as measureless as the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East, and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other men, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Calcol, and Dada, the sons of Mahol. Now, I have no idea who they are, but the point is, obviously, they were pretty wise people at the time. So that the author's saying, yeah, he was really wise. He's even wiser than Ethan. I guess our equivalent would be to say, you know, yeah, I mean, if you played chess against Garry Kasparov, he'd easily win. And if he did mental arithmetic, he beat Carol Vorderman hands down. You know, just think of your household clever names. He's cleverer than them, basically. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. I love that. It's not even rounding. It's not even, you know, he was a songwriter. He wrote about 1,000 songs. No, he wrote 1,005 songs, specifically that many. So he was not just clever. He was literary. He described plant life. He was the world's first naturalist. I'm always slightly nervous of saying that word in a sermon because it sounds a bit like the other word that's almost the same. But he was a naturalist. He described the seed of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He talked about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. People from all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who'd heard of his wisdom. He was famous, and I take it that is because this kind of wisdom is unusual. It is rare. Became internationally famous. This is a country with a king who's actually not an idiot. And their political class is actually morally right. You know, wow, that's unusual. And everyone starts sending delegates to investigate. It is rare. Now, I want us to focus in on just one of these state visits to investigate Solomon's wisdom. And it's the most famous one. And it comes in chapter 10, if you're looking later. And it's the arrival of the Queen of Sheba. Now, this is famous partly because Handel, in his opera Solomon, his oratorio Solomon, wrote a very famous arrival tune that some of you maybe had at your wedding. If you don't know the piece, type it into YouTube and you will recognise it. The Arrival of the Queen of Sheba. I'm not going to sing it now, but I could do if you want afterwards. It's famous because the music is also famous because this is the paragraph in the Bible that gives us quite a lot of classic English idioms. So, for example, I hadn't heard the half of it. That comes from this passage. And it took my breath away. comes from this passage. So get ready, listen out for those phrases. Here is a visit. When the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. I love this. So she's no fool when it comes to foreign diplomacy. Apparently you're quite a clever bloke, she says. Well, I've come with an exam. So she's going to find out. Arriving in Jerusalem was a very great caravan with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold, precious stones. So, in other words, there's a big cash prize, Solomon, and you know, what do you give a man who's got everything? It's got to be a pretty impressive prize. So here's a quiz with a massive prize. And she came and talked with him about everything that was on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon, the palace he built, the food in his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, the burnt offerings he made in the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed and there was no breath left in her. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I didn't believe these things until I came and..." Oh, sorry, one more idiom. "I saw it with my own eyes. Behold, the half was not told me." Wasn't told the half of it. "How happy are your people? How happy your officials who constantly stand before you and hear your wisdom?" And then listen to this bit. "Praise be to the Lord your God who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness." See, here's her insight. This is very unusual. And it must be that God loves your people very much to give them a king like this. So I think we read about Solomon being the richest person. Because we're selfish, we go, "I want to be like him. I want to be Solomon. I wouldn't mind that much cleverness. I wouldn't mind that much cash." But actually, the way that the author's pushing is to say, no. The point is, wouldn't you love to be one of his subjects? Because actually, everyone benefits from this wise, rich king. And the queen sees that. She goes, "Wow, God must really love your country to give you a government like that, that is altruistic and moral, and where there's no shady dealings, and where nobody is trampled on, even if they're at the bottom of the ladder. How kind of God to give you that kind of government." And as we're reading it, I think we ask to ourselves, wouldn't we love to live in that kind of country? I don't want to diss Theresa May and her government, but I think it's fair to say that none of the political rulers that we've had in this country have been entirely altruistic or moral or wise in every situation. Or indeed anywhere else in the country. We read about the scandals about the politicians that constantly disappoint us. We discover about the moral rulings that go the wrong way, or the courts that make the wrong judgments. We hear about people in poverty at the bottom of the ladder. Wouldn't you love to live in a country where everyone was looked after, and where those who ruled did so humbly and morally and practically for others' good? But it's very rare, it's very unusual to find a country like this. And it's unusual even in the Bible. Sometimes we think, it's typical what I expect to find in the Bible. It's all rose-tinted and unrealistic. Actually, in the Bible, this is very unusual. And even in this book of 1 Kings, it's very unusual. We read on about Solomon's later life. We see it all unravels. There's the scandals. The later kings who come after him are rogues and self-seeking and cruel and tyrannical. In fact, you read on in the book, it reads just like a Western newspaper. All of the kind of compromises we're used to. But just for this short period, in this one place, a glimpse of a different kind of government. And you're thinking, wouldn't I love to have this? Well, actually, the God who blessed Solomon with wisdom... is also the God in charge of all history. And one of the things that God likes to do in shaping history is to put in the Old Testament, hundreds of years before Jesus, some little pictures, some little previews of what the rule of Jesus will be like. And actually, it's King Jesus is compared to Solomon for his wisdom. He is described in the New Testament, Jesus is, as the one in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And now we understand, just in this little snapshot of history, a little bit more about what King Jesus' rule is like. It's not just that Jesus is very rich, although he is. He's the heir of the universe. It's not just that Jesus is very clever and can do maths problems quicker than you can and can beat you at chess, although I'm sure he can. It's that Jesus' wisdom is altruistic, to serve others, even to give up his life for others. It's that Jesus' judgments are always objective and moral. He never favoured his political allies or was bribed by somebody or compromised by somebody. He always told it exactly as it was and set out the difference between what was good and what was evil. His wisdom was practical, reaching into every person's family life and work life, every decision we made. And of course, Jesus' wisdom is therefore a great blessing for everyone who knows him as their king. Wouldn't you love to live in a country like Israel in the time of Solomon? Wouldn't you love to live in the kingdom of Jesus with this kind of ruler governing you? But finally, we read that wisdom is very, very rare. In fact, it isn't found anywhere else, because it is in Jesus that are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Let me lead us in prayer as we close. Father, thank you for this little glimpse of a government very unlike any of those that we are used to from our media or from our own experience. Thank you, Father, for the beauty of the wisdom that you gave to Solomon, which is so attractive and such a blessing. And we do praise you, Lord, that there was a king after Solomon in whom were found all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Thank you that we have the opportunity to know that king, to be governed by that king, and even enter into a perfect world, a kingdom over which he is ruling. We praise you for that in Jesus' name. Amen. Next week, the worship of Solomon, the Temple at Jerusalem, the greatest religious piece of architecture ever made. Let's discover what was so good about that. Please come back.